while it's difficult, while it's crushing, it's also a moment of hope.
You're listening to Sound from the student encampment at the University of California, Berkeley, on the anniversary of the Nakba.
This movement, this student movement, this alumni movement.
The students' main demand, disclose and then divest all university funds in the endowment from Israel, including arms manufacturers.
It echoed into the offices of Chancellor Crist. It echoed in the offices of the Berkeley Foundation, the regent, the president of Berkeley.
It's not the first time student encampments have called for divestment. In the 70s and 80s, students protested, successfully, against South African apartheid, and there's an ongoing campaign to force universities to divest from fossil fuels, which has also been partially successful. But what is an endowment, and what does it mean to ask a university to divest? Well, that's the topic of today's show. You'll hear from Kelly Grucki about how universities have changed the way that they invest endowments.
We're at a kind of inflection point because there's been far too much secrecy. Because we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, we can't really gauge what effects there would be from divestment.
And we'll also hear from Andrea Pritchett, who was at an encampment at the University of California, Berkeley, back in the 80s when students were asking for campuses to divest from South African apartheid.
One of our strengths at that time was our resistance to backroom negotiations. You know, as soon as somebody starts to emerge as a leader and they get called into a back room to some kind of negotiation, when they emerge from that negotiation, they're going to be subject to a lot of suspicion and derision.
Stay tuned. All that and more coming up.
You're listening to Making Contact.
Welcome to Making Contact. To start us off today, we're taking a deep dive into the world of endowments. What is an endowment? Why they invested in arms manufacturers in the first place? And to be frank, I'm not a financial expert, and a lot of the language around endowments is deeply financial. So I sat down with someone who is an expert, Kelly Grucki.
Hi, Salima. Thanks for inviting me on. My name is Kelly Grucki, and I'm a founding partner with Pattern Recognition.
Pattern Recognition is a research collective looking into the effects of our increasingly financialized world, especially in higher education. So, Kelly, let's just jump into it. To start, what is an endowment?
An endowment is basically sort of like an investment pool. You might think of it as a retirement fund for universities, generally funded by donors that the university uses to support all kinds of operations. And usually they're fairly complex structures, sometimes as many as 1,400 different components, depending on what the money is earmarked for. And so the funds are intended to be used in perpetuity to support various operations of an educational institution.
The endowment primarily comes from alumni donations. You know, when your former university sends you mail every year asking for money, that money goes into the endowment. Most of the time, it goes into a general fund, so it can be used for basically anything the university needs, like equipment or scholarships or buildings. Sometimes universities have very big donors.
Like Griffin at Harvard, he made the biggest single donation to Harvard, and I think it was in the realm of around $600 million or so.
And the money from rich donors like that can be earmarked for a specific use, to fund a particular program or construct a lab, which is why buildings are often named after very rich people and not someone like me who maybe donated the dollar in 2012. Now, the size of endowments varies. Some endowments are truly massive.
At the top end, you have places like Yale, Harvard, Stanford, whose endowments tend to measure in the tens of billions of dollars. Then you have a whole range of institutions that have somewhat smaller, $1 to $2 billion. Some state schools have, because they get a lot of money from the state too, don't have as big of endowments as other places. But you can say that generally the trend has been towards, you know, establishing an endowment as big as an institution can possibly make it. So trying to get as many donors as possible, the more money that you have, the more you can fund with that money potentially.
These days, universities also get money from other streams of income. MIT, for example, receives billions in funding from the Department of Defense. And that's something to keep in mind. A modern university is a huge money-making endeavor. Providing education is sometimes a very small part of what they do, whether we agree with that or not.
What came out with Columbia was that the actual revenues that Columbia gets from its students is relatively small compared to other sources of income. It's a huge landowner in New York City. It has a hospital. Institutions with enormous endowments that have a lot of other operations do kind of raise the question about what the principal mission of the institution actually is. And it may be time to revise the idea that these kinds of big institutions are principally institutions of higher education. I think there's an evolution into something that's a little bit more hybrid, but the derogation of education, of higher education, into a kind of minor operation is, I think, a serious issue.
So now we have some idea of what endowments are and how big they are. There's billions of dollars wrapped up in university endowments around the country, which makes them a great target for organizing divestment campaigns. But there's a small problem, and this is something I didn't know about before talking to Kelly. The nature of college endowments has fundamentally changed in the past 30 years. One of the reasons modern endowments have gotten so big has something to do with what's called the Yale model. And this is where things start to get really interesting for organizers who are planning divestment campaigns. So back in the 70s and 80s, universities were still invested in public funds, so things like the stock market. But in the 90s, the Yale model changed all of that.
It was basically a portfolio strategy pioneered by David Swensen at Yale. And what he did was start to invest in a lot of kinds of financial instruments that previously hadn't really been used. And we're talking about the world of alternative investments, also called private funds. So we're talking hedge funds, venture capital, real estate investment trusts, private equity, things like that, which are higher risk, but also, so the theory goes, have the potential for higher yield. So when Swensen was doing this, it was quite unique. He published a book basically detailing the strategy and told people, you know, don't try this at home.
At the time, his investment strategy was pretty new and very successful. Yale's endowment ballooned under his stewardship.
In the years following his pioneering method of portfolio management, a lot of other institutions, including much smaller ones, have basically adopted his strategies for managing their portfolios, which means that ever larger allocations of resources have gone into the world of private funds.
Private funds are exempt from the Investment Company Act of 1940, which is supposed to regulate the world of finance by protecting the public if investments go south. But let's say you're really rich and want to throw all of your money into high-risk investments and lose it all. Then that's your problem, because supposedly it won't affect the broader economy.
But fast forward to where we are now, you're seeing all sorts of entities investing in this world of private funds, which was once restricted to, you know, high net worth individuals. You're seeing people's pension funds go into these in ever larger allocations.
And the world of private funds is extremely complicated. I lost a good portion of my life trying to understand them while researching for this show. So even universities will hire outside managers, like hedge fund managers, to invest their money into an intricate web of holdings.
What that does essentially is basically takes that money private. These investments are governed by contract. And they're so secretive that I think only a few of them have really been leaked, what the terms of the contract are. But that means that you lose a substantial amount of transparency, which was pretty much intact if you're dealing with the world of stocks and bonds and publicly traded investments.
Private funds are also more vulnerable because they're volatile. Universities suffered huge losses to their endowments in the 2008 market crash, for example.
And that propelled really a wave, a kind of a second wave of uber financialization. So what do you do when you're in a situation where you need this money to fund various parts of your operations and the money's not there? Well, you know, you go into something that maybe has the potential for greater returns. But it's not at all clear at this point, according to a lot of experts in the field, that those kinds of investments are necessarily making any more money than, say, a standard index fund would. So the whole rationale for this hyper-financialized and very secretive model of investing is that you make more money at it. But it's not clear even at this point that this is the case.
That's why the students' first demand to disclose the university's holdings is so important. Only the outside managers really understand what's going on, and they're sitting behind a curtain of secrecy, contracts, and financial jargon. Even the heads of the endowment might not know where the investments are going. But the argument on the part of the students that maybe the university should know where the money's going and should divest some of it is often portrayed as naive. Many financial experts argue that they have what's called a fiduciary responsibility to get a good return on their money. So they have to invest in whatever makes the most profit, even if it's a weapons producer.
Yeah, I think that's basically the kind of message that is getting received by people who are daring to question or who would like to see their institutions align more with their own principles. The responsibility to grow the endowment is a matter of fiscal responsibility. I'm not saying that it's, you know, unethical. I'm just saying that there's a distinction, an operative distinction between fiduciary responsibility and ethical responsibility. There are all sorts of reasons why it's very hard to divest, but you have to keep in mind that, you know, I think some of these claims about fiduciary responsibility are untested. Meaning, I think that there are multiple reasons why that argument would be made, that it would be irresponsible, that the university would be damaged. We don't really know. I mean, a skilled investment advisor should be able to navigate this terrain and invest money in all sorts of things all over the world. But because we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, we can't really gauge what effects there would be from divestment.
What Kelly is saying here is important. It's possible that universities could divest without hurting their bottom line. What if they made just as much money investing in public funds?
And so people should be willing to consider that their investments align with their stated values.
You're listening to Kelly Grocki talking about university endowments and divestment, and we have a lot more to dig into right after the break. We're just jumping in to remind you that you're listening to Making Contact. If you'd like more information, please visit us online at radioproject.org. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to Making Contact. In the first half of the show, we sat down with Kelly Grocki, who researches higher education and financialization, to learn about endowments, what they are, how they function, and how they're invested. And we're continuing that conversation in the second half. And specifically, I wanted to know how these new investment models, such as the Yale model, might affect how students run divestment campaigns. Okay, Andrea, I guess a big question is, let's say a university says, okay, we're going to divest. The thing is, if a lot of the endowment's holdings are secret, is it possible to know whether a university has divested or not?
You're absolutely right. There's no real way to check. I mean, you would have to rely on trust, basically. And it would probably be a kind of secondhand trust because the university outsources a lot of its investment activities, most do at any rate, to outside managers. So you've got trust two levels removed. The more serious question is that the landscape is very different than what it was back in the 70s, 80s, 90s when divestment from South Africa was going on. And that was a long-term campaign. It took a long time, and there was a lot of resistance to it, too. But at the time, I think most colleges and universities wouldn't have as heavily been invested in the Yale model type thing with the substantial allocations to private funds. It's not even clear that in some cases they can even publicly declare what investments related to the war in Gaza they might have. They might not even be able to disclose this because of the nature of the contracts. If they did that potentially they could be sued because these things are considered the intellectual property of the fund managers.
And that's a huge problem that we just heard. Not only are some universities in the dark about how their endowments are being invested, just trying to find out where their money is going might trigger an intellectual property lawsuit. So, transparency wouldn't just benefit the students involved in the current divestment campaign for Palestine. It could benefit everyone involved in higher education. The entire university community should have some idea of where the money is going and how it's being spent.
What's happened in Gaza has really the potential to blow up a lot of this secrecy and to raise a lot of really important questions about the relationship between, you know, ethics and finance and what kind of world we want to live in.
So what does all of this mean for organizing? Well, for one, Kelly thinks that transparency is a good start.
Demanding transparency is an excellent issue to organize around. I've done a little bit of that myself with an alumni organization, and we've insisted on it for quite a long time. It's very hard, but as nonprofit institutions of higher education, I think transparency should be part of what they do as a matter of routine.
But she also says that it's important not to get too bogged down in the financial jargon and the opaque rules, because at the end of the day, the students have an ethical argument that isn't addressed by the rules of finance. It's a different, unshakable core the students can hold on to.
There's a political virtue, I think, to a certain intransigence. You know, that no matter what you're told about the reality, the complexity, the ethical demands remain. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't learn about and educate yourself about the world of finance and the complexities involved with actually divesting. But there's also just the insistence on the ethical center of the message, because I don't think that finance has anything really that is equivalent to that.
That was Kelly Grocki, founding partner of Pattern Recognition, focusing on financialized higher education. And we're not quite done yet. To end the show, we're hearing from Andrea Pritchett, a former student organizer from the campaign against South African apartheid. Because one thing I've learned over the years covering social movements is that nothing we do is completely new, and that we always have so much to learn from the past. Andrea wanted to share what she learned from her time at the encampment back in the 80s and what advice she would give to students today. Here's Andrea.
My name is Andrea Pritchett, and I am a co-founder of Brooklyn Cop Watch. I'm an eighth grade history teacher, and I'm a longtime resident of UC Berkeley and a graduate of UC Berkeley. In the fall of 1984, there was a lot of unrest in South Africa, and folks were making protests across the country. The Democratic Party was actually leading the charge and sponsoring arrests at South African consulates in protest of the apartheid regime. Through the winter in December of 1984 at UC Berkeley, 38 people got arrested. And then by the spring of 85, there was a higher level of student activism, and we began a sit-in that lasted for 6 weeks on the steps of the main administration building called Sproul Hall.
I asked Andrea what she thought worked during that time, especially what tactics were useful.
Well, what worked was reaching out across constituencies and really building up some serious unity with labor unions.
She said that the ILWU strike really made an impression on the students. That's the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union. They refused to unload ships from South Africa for weeks and faced serious consequences.
Their example of sacrifice, I think, really infused us with a level of seriousness that created momentum that lasted for the next couple of years, honestly.
The strike also reminded the students to leave campus and make connections so that they could share the wider call for divestment.
Taking the time to reach out and go make presentations to organizations that are not on the steps. What we learned is that, yes, the sit-in is important, but it's at the end of the day, it's symbolic. It wasn't stopping the functioning of the administration building. It wasn't stopping anything. It was just an organizing hub. I'll tell you another thing that actually kind of worked was when the faculty senate got activated, they created something called the California Plan. A professor of economics named Claire Brown and some other professors wanted to counter some of the propaganda from the university, where the university was saying things like, well, if we divest, we're going to hurt the Black South Africans and we're going to suppress the economy and those poor people. We can't do that to them. And they had all these justifications. They also said that we have a fiduciary responsibility to get as much money as we can.
Fiduciary responsibility. Sound familiar? We talked about this argument in the first half of the show. In Andrea's time, because there wasn't so much secrecy around the endowment, they were able to dismiss the claims of fiduciary responsibility.
So what the Academic Senate did is they did an end run around those arguments. And by creating a step-by-step divestment plan, an analysis of the impacts of divestment, showing that the university portfolio would do as well or better by divesting from those companies, it really gave us a power.
But there were also a few things Andrea says current students should be wary of in this moment. And first is actually a surprising one. Don't get too involved in negotiations, especially if they're behind closed doors.
And so trying to avoid, you know, having leaders, honestly, because leaders, I think it's the nature of the beast at this point that we don't trust leaders. You know, as soon as somebody starts to emerge as a leader and they get called into a back room to some kind of negotiation, when they emerge from that negotiation, they're going to be subject to a lot of suspicion and derision. One of our strengths at that time was our resistance to backroom negotiations. We said, look, these are our demands. If you have any updates on what progress you want to make towards those demands, write it up, we'll copy it, and distribute the information. Because we don't need to haggle, because actually we don't have any power. The only power we have is this little encampment, you know, that could be swept away at a moment's notice. It's not real power. I think folks just have to be really wary about what you give up when you're in a negotiation with the university. But there's a lot of pressure. People go into these traditions. They yield before the university's power. And they think like, oh my God, if we don't do it the way they do it, they're going to call off negotiations. Well, let them call it off.
Andrea told me that she's speaking from experience and that at one point they slipped and they did end up in a negotiation with the university. And it did not go well.
But what happened to us was that we got kind of maneuvered into a back room. And they're like, oh, you guys, you can have whatever you want. You're going to have a big protest at the regents meeting. How many porta potties do you need? How many shuttle buses do you need? It wasn't about porta potties. It was about police. And they were getting us to give them information about our organizing so that they could better estimate how to stop our protests.
Andrea also cautioned against trying to keep an encampment going indefinitely. It's important to keep the end goal in mind, not just the tactic.
My hat is off to the UC Berkeley students who ended their encampment. Because at the end of the day, we remember that encampments are a tactic. They're not the end in itself. The point isn't to keep the encampment going as long as you can, you know. Because what inevitably happens in these encampment situations is that they can get bogged down in logistics. That the whole point, you find yourself more worried about will there be bagels in the morning for the campers than going out and talking to the Ask Me or SEIU locals. It's like, wait, we're supposed to be doing political work over here, you know, and staying light and staying mobile and being able to respond to changing, you know, to a dynamic situation. The mistake that we made was that we fell in love with the tactic. They just wanted to stay there indefinitely. And so people end up voting with their feet, you know, they go home. And as summer was approaching here and the reality that a lot of students were going to go back to their homes, I'm really proud of those organizers who said, we're going to have closure and we're going to end this. And we're not going to let the police end it. I hope folks around the country take note of that, too, that it's okay to stop. It doesn't mean defeat. It means a change in tactic because you got to keep your goal in mind.
When Andrew and I were talking about the current student encampments, she also told me that she was really impressed. For one, the example of the students has already spread beyond the university into other areas.
I can personally thank the students for creating the momentum that allowed my union yesterday to vote, the executive board 25-4 in favor of divestment.
As a middle school teacher, Andrea is part of the Berkeley Federation of Teachers, and the vote to divest means that they're pulling their pension funds out of Israel. Berkeley is a small town, but Andrea says that if they scale up, this could be a game changer.
If we get the other unions in California to make that same call, which is what we've approved and that's our action plan, if we can get the California Federation of Teachers to call for CalSTRS to divest, they felt like $330 billion that they control. And so if California teachers, just that one constituency, can prevail upon our union and influence CalSTRS, and if that becomes, if these dominoes start to fall, we will change the trajectory of this. I really do believe it. So that, don't underestimate the ways that these actions ripple out. I'm a middle school teacher. We're having walkouts. We've had 3 walkouts of middle school students desperate to get up to the encampment and be with the college kids to speak their hearts. So there's a lot of ways that we impact people that we don't get to see. It affects people.
And that part of the conversation really stood out to me. The encampments made such an impact on Berkeley teachers that they voted to divest their pensions. That's huge. They've also inspired young students to walk out and join the encampments at the university nearby. College campuses are sometimes very isolated from the communities that they sit in, but the example of the Students for Palestine broke that barrier, and that's not a small feat. However, despite all the similarities between Andrea's time in the encampment in the 80s and the student protests today, there are some stark differences. While there was plenty of backlash to the divestment campaigns in the 80s, the students weren't being physically attacked by counter-protesters. The encampment at UCLA, for example, was viciously attacked one night.
When you're under siege like that, when you feel vulnerable, not only to the police, but to these random attacks, the temptation is to barricade yourself in. But we have to be careful, because when we barricade ourselves in, we keep our connection to the wider public gets broken. And that's what they want to do. They want to isolate our movements. We have to, instead of falling for that, we're not an armed resistance. We're not a resistance movement. We're a political movement. And I think remembering that how do we bring in new folks? That's always the question. How to keep the door open despite whatever kind of obstacles or challenges or attacks we might have to endure.
That was Andrea Pritchett, middle school teacher and co-founder of Berkeley Cop Watch. And we'd love to hear from our audience. Are you on a board of directors for an organization that's thinking of divesting? Are you a student that has questions? Are you a worker that's currently trying to divest your retirement funds? There's so many ways the promise of the encampments can continue to affect how we think about money and institutions. Leave us a comment, and as always, you can find links on divestment and our guests on our website, www.radioproject.org. And that does it for today's show. I'm Salima Hamarani. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.